I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
The eight world leaders who met in Evian, France today made lots of promises. They said they will turn around their weak economies. They pledged to promote good business standards in the wake of corporate scandals in the U.S. and elsewhere. And they promised to cooperate on terrorism and rebuilding Iraq. President Bush, who arrived late and has already left for the Middle East, had a tête-à-tête with French President Jacques Chirac today, their first meeting since Chirac disagreed with Bush administration policy over the war with Iraq. Mr. Bush said the G8 meeting had reinforced his belief that cooperation was critical in solving global issues.
A united Europe working with America can do a lot of good. We can do a lot of good on issues such as fighting terror, or working on matters such as proliferation. We can do a lot of good to help those who suffer in the world. So the expectation is, at least as far as I'm concerned, have been met.
Well, as the richest countries meet in France, population experts say they should be paying more attention to demographics. For instance, it takes the 15 European nations combined a year to achieve the population growth India achieves in 6 days. And some say when wealthy countries face shrinking populations, it can threaten their very future. Well, joining us on the line from New York City is Joseph Shammy. He's director of the Population Division at the United Nations. And Joseph, why do you and others think that countries with more money and less birth rate or immigration are in crisis?
Well, what happens immediately is fewer births means you have fewer children being born in the hospitals. That means you have fewer children relative to the elderly. So the resources have to be reallocated away from the schools to the elderly. Mm. In addition, in a few years, if not sooner, you'll have a decrease in the labor force. And that then starts having an impact in terms of paying for the pensions. And this also has an impact on the economics, of course, real estate prices and housing markets and
right. So on.
Mm.
You speak of ghost towns in Europe.
Some communities in Northern Europe now where the average age is well over 50 because many of the families there either had few or no children, and the children that grew up went to other cities which were economically more dynamic. Mm. So this will have impact not only in terms of housing, in terms of economics, in terms of pensions. Every sector of the economy will be affected.
As you said, fewer workers, fewer, let's say, scientists who would be the young coming into the colleges, fewer soldiers.
You'll have fewer cohorts going into all of these activities.
Well, how does it affect the balance of power? I'm thinking, for instance, of the example of Pakistan and Russia, both nuclear powers.
Well, a few decades ago, in the early 50s, right after World War II, Russia was almost three times as populous as Pakistan. Today, they're roughly the same size, and in 50 years, by mid-century, Russia will be one-third the size of Pakistan, and that'll affect geopolitics. And the same thing's occurring with the United States and the European Union.
Well, let's speak about that, because according to a recent report in The Economist, the U.S. has both population growth and wealth, and some of the population growth is more due to migration than to birth. But what does that mean for the future of the U.S. as a world power?
The U.S. has very dynamic prospects for the future. It has a growing population. It will probably increase by more than a third by mid-century. So we're going to see 400 million for the U.S. by 2050. Second, its population is less elderly, less aged than many of the Europeans.
Because of the immigrants.
Because of the immigrants and also because of a higher fertility level. The U.S., in contrast to Europe, has about two children per couple.
And tell me this, Joseph, that's part of a calculation for a country reproducing itself, if you will.
Exactly. It's very straightforward. If you have a mother and a father, you need two children to replace them. Anything less, the population declines in the absence of migration. And anything more, if you have three children per couple, of course, you're going to be increasing by about 50%. Mm. So in the U.S., we're right at the level needed for replacement, two children per couple. Mm. In Europe, such as in Italy, you have 1.2. It's about half that level. And you can understand if every generation is having about half the level of children needed to be replacement, it declines relatively rapidly.
And some of the Arab countries we read, I'm thinking of Saudi Arabia, for instance, are almost entirely young people.
It's exactly correct. Their average ages are very different than we see in the West. Some of the youngest ages are in Africa and Western Asia. In contrast, we have some of the oldest ages in Europe, such as Italy, Greece, and, of course, Japan also being at the top.
Mm. Well, Joseph, it's fascinating work. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Joseph Shami is director of the Population Division at the UN in New York.
A new U.S.-British plan that outlines how Baghdad's interim government will be formed is sparking dissent and discontent among Iraqis who expected more input into the process. Under the new plan, coalition authorities will appoint 25 to 30 Iraqis who will then nominate people who will serve in senior government positions, a far cry from the original plan to create an interim government chosen by more than 300 Iraqis. Some Iraqis see the move as a backhanded way for coalition forces to put their own people in power. Joining us now to discuss the new interim government is John Danishevsky, who's covering the story for the Los Angeles Times. Welcome, John. John Danishevsky in Baghdad, can you hear me? Trying to reach John Danishevsky in Baghdad. We seem to be having a technical problem at the moment. We'll try to get John Danishevsky on the phone. We're going to move on now to Robin.
Well, meanwhile, Saddam Hussein was betrayed by one of his cousins, a senior Republican Guard general, who made a deal with the United States not to defend Baghdad. This, according to the Journal du Dimanche in France. The total absence of a coordinated defense in the Iraqi capital surprised many observers during the war, and there have been rumors of backroom deals ever since. Well, now the French newspaper is confirming some of those rumors. According to the paper, General Maher Soufiane Al-Tikriti flew out of Baghdad in a U.S. aircraft, along with 20 family members and several $100,000 cash. 48 hours later, U.S. troops were in the heart of the city. At the same time, the Pentagon reported that the general was killed at a checkpoint. Gilles Delafon covers the Middle East for the Journal du Dimanche, and he joins us from Paris. Hello.
Hello.
Well, tell us, according to your story, General Al-Tikriti ordered his troops not to defend Baghdad. In exchange, he was flown out of the country. How was such a deal negotiated?
Well, that's all the question. What we know is that, of course, Maher Soufiane Al-Tikriti gave order to different generals that we have interviewed not to fight. And that was the most astonishing thing, as you have seen, that nobody really fight at the entrance of the American troops in Baghdad.
Well, in fact, the thinking going into this war was that Saddam's forces would fall quickly, except in Baghdad, where it was assumed there would be a big fight. Are you saying that this will change our understanding of the war?
Yes, of course. It has been confirmed by different sources that Maher Soufiane Al-Tikriti was in touch with American intelligence since weeks or months, maybe, and that, of course, on the 8th of April, he boarded aboard a C-130 airplane, American military airplane, and left the country with his families and two other generals. This has been confirmed since by other different sources.
Well, tell us, who are your sources?
Well, the sources is a guy very close to Saddam Hussein's inner circle. He is a guy close from Uday, and he told me about that, and this has been confirmed by another opposition member. All this has been since confirmed by other sources close to the family that flew out of Iraq. Now, the main question in all that is, since when did this general was dealing with the United States? If he was dealing since weeks, that's not have a lot of consequences. If he is dealing since months or maybe years, it means that all this has been planned, knowing that there is a mole inside Baghdad, if you see what I mean.
What are we to make of the U.S. reports that the general was killed?
Well, show us the body. I don't believe in that story. The astonishing fact is this communique from the 8th of April that they are saying that Maher Soufiane Al-Tikriti died on a marine checkpoint. Of course, this appears as an obvious will to these guys, the flu of the general. So I think that you will see that one day all this will be pretty clear.
Well, Gilles, in the meantime, the Pentagon is not commenting on your story, but no one in the American press is reporting on it. Why do you think that is?
Well, if you look very carefully in the press, the Americans have recognized to have talks with Iraqi general during the siege of Baghdad. It has been saying, without mentioning precise name. Well, now, why do people are not confirming that? I don't know. I know that I have American friends, journalists, who are investigating the story on their side. I think they are expecting a confirmation on the American side. All we have for the moment are Iraqi sources. Mm.
And, Gilles, one last question. Do you have any idea where the general is?
Not at all. Not at all. All I know is that the third source that has confirmed my story to the AFP said that he is probably in Europe.
Well, Gilles Delafon, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Gilles Delafon is with the Journal du Dimanche in Paris.
Well, Robin, we now have John Danishevsky of the L.A. Times on the line from Baghdad to talk about a significant shift in approach by coalition authorities in Iraq. Under a new plan, U.S. and British authorities in Iraq will appoint 25 to 30 Iraqis who will then nominate Iraqis to serve in senior government positions. Now, that's a far cry from the original plan to create an interim government chosen by more than 300 Iraqis in a big conference. Why the change, John?
Well, the coalition officials, the occupying powers, were a little afraid that holding a big national conference at this time would be divisive and it might result in a interim government process that would be drawn out too long at a time when there are a lot of problems facing the country and everybody agrees that things should move quickly.
But doesn't it look like...
I think there's also some fear that they want to have this first interim group be well-balanced and are a little bit afraid of the consequences of just leaving the decision entirely in the hands of the Iraqi opposition parties.
Some speculation, John, though, that losers in this new plan could be the Kurdish and Shiite factions who could get shut out.
Yes, I don't think they'll be shut out, but certainly their influence will be diluted because this gives the Americans and the British to bring in people who were not part of those groups, who were inside Iraq during the time of Saddam Hussein. And it's felt that for many Iraqis, they will identify more with people who are inside the country than who are outside.
John, very briefly, what kind of reception has this gotten so far in Baghdad?
Well, it's it has not gone over that well, especially among the Shiites, who do sense that this is a move to curtail their ascendant power. And on the street, there's a lot of sense from ordinary Iraqis that the United States is trying to control the process, that they don't really want an authentically indigenous Iraqi government. And it raises, again, the questions, are the Americans here as liberators or occupiers?
John, finally, just in a word or two, how soon could we have an interim government?
Well, we were talking to them today, and they're saying 6 weeks to 2 months. So the latter half of July is what they're talking, what they're shooting for.
John Danishevsky of the L.A. Times, thanks for joining us finally from Baghdad.
Thank you.
Just ahead, President Bush logs thousands of miles this week, but will he reap political mileage back home?
And later in the show, who is alleged Olympic bomber Eric Rudolph? And why did he find safe haven in Murphy, North Carolina?
From Boston University, this is WBUR Boston's NPR News Station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by William Gallagher Associates, primary sponsor of Marketplace on WBUR, specializing in directors and officers' liability insurance for publicly traded companies, WGAINS.com, and Restaurant Clio at the Elliott Hotel, named one of America's 50 best hotel restaurants by Food & Wine Magazine 2003. Reservation 617-267-1607.
I'm Bill Littlefield. A tradition there was that's been absent of late. It's returned to us thanks to a kind twist of fate. The Brewer's Offering is back, and I'm pleased to announce you can come sample wonderful brews by the ounce, plus games and prizes and food for your plate. Now, you won't want to miss this, so write down the date. It's happening Saturday, June 21st. Bring your appetite, friends, and a moderate thirst.
For your tickets to the Brewer's Offering and Food Expo, call 800-909-9287.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Well, President Bush is on the road plenty in the United States, but it's a rare enough week that he's overseas. Since the weekend, though, Bush has been out of the country on something of a lightning tour of Russia, then France, and today he swoops off to the Middle East. To discuss what he's up to internationally and problems back home he's only temporarily getting some distance on, we turn to members of our D.C. roundtable. Joining us on the line are David Shribman, executive editor of the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Welcome, David.
Hello.
And Jack Farrell, Washington bureau chief and assistant managing editor of the Denver Post. Hi, Jack.
Hi.
Jack, start with you. First of all, splashed on the front page of newspapers around the world, President Bush shaking hands with his dear friend, French President Jacques Chirac. Though the affection may be a bit less than ardent, there was no kiss on the cheek, was there?
Reality is going to impose its ugly head. These are two huge Western democracies that cannot afford to be alienated forever. And while the immediate choreography may be awkward in the long run, you'll see the two countries getting back together.
Hmm. David, why did President Bush seemingly go out of his way when he was in St. Petersburg, Russia, over the weekend to show a degree of warmth to Russian President Vladimir Putin, who no more supported the war in Iraq than French President Chirac did?
I think because Mr. Putin has more weapons than Mr. Chirac does. He potentially can play a bigger role in the world community, and because it was yet another way to snub Mr. Chirac. You know, you were talking about symbolism and the kissing and the lack of kissing. You'll notice that the president was holding hands with the gentleman from Saudi Arabia, no hand-holding with France.
Body language. We've churned this question before, but let's address it just briefly again. Jack, how much does it matter whether we get along with the French or not?
Well, it matters a lot. I mean, this is a very shrunken, tiny world. We may think that we can do what we want for our interests forever, but it doesn't work that way. And I think that one thing that you're looking at in economics, the rise and fall of the dollar is a clear indication.
Mm.
But, you know, these things mean a little bit more to the French than they do to the Americans. Right now. Now, they may not some other time, and the one thing that we may need the French for, well, one of several things, but urgently, will be some help in the war against terror, because a lot of the folks who are fighting us in the war against terror do more than change planes in Paris.
Well, David, it's kind of ironic, isn't it? Because the French really have helped us in the war against terror, haven't they?
Yes, they have, and there's more help to come, because I'm convinced that Paris is one of the main centers of terrorist activity or terrorist planning or finance. And so it's very important that we be in good odor with the French.
Yeah, if you'll notice, the president gave a bunch of interviews before he started this trip to European newspapers, and especially to the French media. And what he said over and over again in every one of those interviews was how grateful he was to the intelligence agencies of foreign countries for cooperating in the war on terror.
Yeah, yeah. Well, let's turn to the Middle East, where today, the president wings off to meet with Prime Ministers Ariel Sharon of Israel and Palestinian Prime Minister Mahmoud Abbas. Now, of course, they'll be talking about the roadmap for peace that calls for a Palestinian state in 2 years. Bush is the first U.S. president to explicitly call for a Palestinian state. But word already this morning that this meeting of the minds isn't expected to even result in a joint statement. David, what are you expecting?
Well, so obviously, something has been cooked in advance, or else the president wouldn't have gone that
right.
long a distance to come back with nothing. But how they spin what little they get will be both an art form worthy of watching and a diplomatic signal worthy of following. So it's very difficult to know at this juncture what they will get, but we're getting every indication that it won't be big.
Jack, what do you sense?
I have to admire the guy for his sort of Wilsonian audacity. I mean, to just announce that you're going to pursue this, it's something that he had to do, of course, because you just can't have one hand of the American Eagle has arrows and the other has an olive branch. You just can't have just the arrows when you deal with the Middle East. But, you know, this morning he said he's going to invest as much time as it takes to get something happening here.
Yeah.
So, I know committed, hardcore Democrats who over this weekend told me, boy, if this guy can bring peace to the Middle East, there's no way I'm not going to vote for him.
You said it. And, David, there's some interesting, naturally, domestic politics lurking behind Bush's commitment to a Palestinian state. One interesting wild card here, David. Some 3 million evangelical Christians didn't vote in the last election. They're generally very opposed to a Palestinian state. And there's word that Karl Rove, Bush's political advisor, doesn't want to upset them.
No, he doesn't want to upset them.
It's a problem for Bush over there in the Middle East as far as throwing all his weight behind what he apparently and supposedly believes in, a Palestinian state, right?
But many, many years ago, President Kennedy said to govern is to choose, and pretty soon the president's going to have to make a choice. But among the things he's going to have to choose among the factors, let's not forget all of those Arab-American voters as well, many of them concentrated in the swing state of Michigan.
I also think, David, don't you think that the number of Christian voters who would vote based on an apocalyptic notion of where the Middle East fits in their view of cosmology is probably kind of small compared to some of the other social issues that drive Christian voters to the polls.
Right, because Christian voters are driven to the polls, and we know this from poll data, by other issues and by very subtle issues of lifestyle and culture. So it's not necessarily only issues like this that drive people to the polls or keep them away.
Finish up, guys. Let's turn briefly our spotlight back home. We've just learned in the last couple of days a little more about that big tax cut signed into law by President Bush. Millions of poor people, it turns out, won't be getting a cut after all, right, Jack?
Well, the signs as we go on the air are that they might. They might be reopening this to make sure that this equity issue doesn't get out of hand.
Yeah, this is the question of whether parents of 1 in 6 children won't get that $400 per child tax credit, and some 8 million other poor people suddenly excluded at the last minute in the Senate version of this, too.
Exactly, and it's proved to be embarrassing for the Republicans. And, you know, in the back of my mind, I really, this is rank speculation, but I wouldn't be surprised if at the last minute, as they sat there behind closed door, they said, well, let's cut this, and if everybody raises this thing, we can always put it back in, but at least this will get the bill through and we'll get what we wanted, which is a big bill for the president to sign by Memorial Day.
Well, I agree with Jack, and I think the watchword for the day is the checks are in the mail, but even more checks may be in the mail.
David Shribman, thanks very much. Jack Farrell, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
Jack Farrell is Washington Bureau Chief and Assistant Managing Editor of the Denver Post, and David Shribman, of course, Executive Editor of the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Tomorrow on Here and Now, how new brain scans are changing psychiatry.
And horseback riding lessons in the middle of Manhattan.
That's tomorrow. Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by AstraZeneca, a worldwide pharmaceutical company committed to pushing the boundaries of science to meet the world's medical needs. AstraZeneca, life-inspiring ideas. By the Catered Affair, since 1979, creating chef-inspired cuisine for intimate dinner parties to festive galas in greater New England. Information on the web at cateredaffair.com. And by the Boston Early Music Festival and exhibition June 9th through the 15th, presenting music of the German Baroque and the fully staged opera Ariadne. Tickets at bemf.org. Coming up later this hour in Here and Now, literary critic Steve Allman takes a look at historical novels old and new. This is WBUR. It's 1229.
Ian Kerr, captain of the research vessel Odyssey.
When you're lying in your bunk at night, if there's a whale nearby, the hull or your cabin will resonate, so you're inside of a speaker. And while I'm not afraid of the dark, I wonder how those old sailors felt when they heard the sirens of the sea calling them.
Now is your chance to experience a 10-day voyage sailing among the great whales aboard the Odyssey on the WBUR online auction. Make a bid for the news.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, proudly supporting public radio and serving the community, on the web at MathWorks.com.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, after 5 years on the run, Eric Rudolph faces accusations that he was the Olympic Park bomber.
Is Rudolph, who's also accused of bombing 2 women's health clinics and a gay nightclub, a Christian terrorist?
And we go back in time with a discussion about historical fiction.
People choose to be incredibly close to history and really use those facts as a guideline, and other people really choose to just use it as a departure point.
These stories coming up Here and Now.
I'm Marianne Nichols. The Federal Communications Commission has voted 3-2 to relax decades-old rules restricting media ownership. Chairman Michael Powell pushed the measure, which will allow companies to buy more TV stations and own a newspaper and a broadcast outlet in the same city.
I am confident and proud of the job we have done. I believe that our actions will advance our diversity and localism's goals and maintain a vigorously competitive environment.
Jonathan Adelstein, one of the two Democrats on the commission who voted against the rule change, says the changes are likely to damage the media landscape for decades.
The majority chose to pursue gratuitous deregulation. This is by far the most dramatic weakening of our media ownership rules this country has ever seen.
Some lawmakers critical of the FCC have proposed legislation to counter the relaxed regulations. Bombing suspect Eric Rudolph appeared before a federal judge today, the first time since his capture, acknowledging his identity but not entering a plea. Attorney General John Ashcroft says Rudolph will first face trial in Birmingham, Alabama, where an abortion clinic was bombed in 1998, then Atlanta, the site of the 1996 Olympic bombing. President Bush leaves France for Egypt today for a summit meeting with Arab leaders. The president is pushing the U.S.-backed roadmap to peace in the Middle East. Bush says it'll not be easy to end centuries of hostilities, but he says progress is being made. Bush made the remarks during an appearance with French President Jacques Chirac. A new Iraqi military may soon emerge. The U.S. Civil Administrator of Iraq says recruitment for the new Iraqi Corps will begin by the end of the week. Administrator Paul Bremer says the new military will improve Iraq's security and take out-of-work men off the streets. Officers who held the rank of colonel or above in Saddam Hussein's military are barred from joining. Iran is countering U.S. suspicions about nuclear weapons by inviting the U.S. to help Iran develop its nuclear power program. Iran's foreign minister says his country is not developing nuclear weapons, and U.S. companies should bid for contracts to build nuclear plants. Iran's supreme leader has banned any business with the U.S., and sanctions in this country bar most trade with Iran. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow is up 140 points at 8990. It's 33 minutes past the hour. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by David L. Babson & Company, investment advisors to private clients and institutions. Working to help clients build and preserve wealth since 1940, David L. Babson in Cambridge and on the web at dlbabson.com. By Mississippi's. Mississippi's prepares 56 different sandwiches named after celebrities. And by Amherst Technologies, partnered with HP to right-size enterprise printing environments. Now hiring sales professionals in all locations. On the web at AmherstTechnologies.com. In the forecast, mostly sunny and breezy today, highs getting up to about 73. Clear and a little bit chilly tonight with lows around 48. Tomorrow, look for partly sunny skies and slightly warmer temperatures around 76. Right now at 65 degrees in Boston. In sports, the Red Sox are off tonight after being swept by Toronto. They'll be taking on the Pirates in Pittsburgh tomorrow. This is WBUR.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Under heavy security, Eric Rudolph entered a U.S. district courtroom in Asheville, North Carolina today, where he was charged with four separate bombings, including an attack on the 1996 Summer Olympics in Atlanta. Two people were killed and about 150 injured in these attacks. Lorenzo Perez, a reporter for the News and Observer in Raleigh, North Carolina, who is covering the Rudolph story, joins me now on the phone. Hello, Lorenzo.
Hi, how are you?
Thanks for joining us, Lorenzo. What happened in the courtroom today?
Well, apparently what happened, it was just a simple court appearance. No plea was entered, but he was represented by Sean Devereaux, an attorney from Waynesville. And a federal judge basically ordered Rudolph to go to trial in Birmingham first.
Yeah, now why is that?
Well, probably speaking out of turn here, but primarily I think just the preponderance of evidence may weigh a little heavier in Birmingham, and they have an eyewitness. But we're not privy to too much of that at this point.
So Eric Rudolph will first face a federal court in Alabama for bombing at an abortion clinic that left one dead, followed by a trial at a federal court in Georgia where he's facing charges of committing three bombings in that state, including that Olympics bombing in 1996.
Apparently so, yes.
Yeah, yeah. What was the reaction in the courtroom? Did you get any sense of that?
just talking to my colleagues there, and apparently it was fairly muted. There was certainly no reaction from Mr. Rudolph himself. He entered the courtroom wearing a dark blue bulletproof vest over an orange jail jumpsuit, and basically the federal judge asked him, "Are you indeed Eric Robert Rudolph?" And all he said was, "Yes, Your Honor." A prosecutor at one point said some of these charges could indeed bring a death sentence, and that brought no reaction from Mr. Rudolph.
Yeah, you know, I asked you about the reaction in the courtroom because some interesting reaction in some of the area where he was caught. Residents in Murphy, North Carolina, in some cases, are standing by Rudolph. Tell me about what's that all about?
Well, I think that's been a little overplayed. I think some people are taking a bit of glee, let's just say, that one of their own caught him as opposed to the FBI. I think people are getting a kick out of that. One of the local radio stations yesterday did play dedicate a song to Mr. Rudolph, and Scott Peterson, of all people, saying that both these men have been found guilty before they even have a trial. But I think just as many people are glad that this is finally coming to a close.
Was it felt in the community that this man was believed by the FBI to be very much in that community for so long?
I think a lot of people that I spoke to over this weekend were actually surprised that he was still around. More than one person told me they assumed either that he was on a beach somewhere or that he had died in the mountains.
What happens next to Eric Rudolph?
Well, he will be getting transported to Birmingham, but we're not sure when that will happen today. Judging from all the care they took just transporting him 2 hours from here in Murphy all the way to Asheville, which is just about a two-hour drive, I imagine they're taking every precaution available.
Right. This is a case that could now go on in one form or another for some time.
Absolutely.
How many? How long?
Well, that's really hard to say. You know, there's been such a spasm of news and flurry of coverage now, but I think we should all anticipate a long haul from this point.
Thanks a lot, Lorenzo, for joining us.
Thank you.
Lorenzo Perez is a reporter for the News and Observer in Raleigh, North Carolina.
Well, he's charged, but who is he? And is Eric Rudolph a Christian terrorist, a member of the Christian Identity Movement? It's a question posed by the Southern Poverty Law Center and others who track hate organizations. And we turn now to Dan Levitas. He's author of the book The Terrorist Next Door, The Militia Movement and the Radical Right, to try to get some answers. Dan, first of all, what is the Christian identity movement?
Well, Christian identity theology is a set of religious beliefs. It's been around for several hundred years, but it was most popularized in the United States in the early 20th century. There are tens of thousands of people in this country who believe it today. And simply stated, it's a theology of racist and anti-Semitic bigotry, which teaches that Jews are the children of Satan, black people and other racial and ethnic minorities are subhuman, and posits the peculiar notion that white Anglo-Saxon Christians are actually the true descendants of the lost tribes of Israel.
Well, why is Eric Rudolph thought to be aligned with this group and its thinking?
Well, Eric Rudolph's mother allegedly took Eric when he was an impressionable young teenager for a several-month period of time. I've heard reports as long as 8 months, actually, to stay at a Christian identity encampment in southern Missouri run by a man named Daniel Gaiman, the encampment of the Church of Israel in Shell City, Missouri.
We should say they say they are not aligned with the Christian identity movement, but their ideology would seem to be.
Well, that's an absolute false declaration. It is wholly Christian identity theology and viciously hateful at that. Further, Eric Rudolph himself and his mother and family members were, some of his family members were quite close to a man named Nord Davis, who lived in North Point, North Carolina. Mr. Davis is now deceased, but for many years, Davis, who was a Christian identity adherent and advocate, ran paramilitary trainings and was very active on the radical right in paramilitary circles. Further, you have with Eric Rudolph a history of him espousing anti-Semitism, denying that the Holocaust occurred.
Right, he wrote a paper in the ninth grade denying the Holocaust.
That's correct. So it's you know, there are a lot of things that point certainly to hardcore anti-Semitism and racism in his background and people he associated with. Whether or not he was an orthodox follower of Christian identity theology isn't clearly known, but that definitely, I would believe, certainly has influenced his political outlook, you know, on the abortion issue as well as on other issues, including the bombing of the Olympic, the Olympics.
Well, I want to ask you about that, Dan, because the bombing of the clinics which offered abortions and of the gay nightclub would make sense, if you will, in the context of the Christian identity movement. But why the Olympics?
Well, if you look at the letters that were allegedly sent and signed or by Rudolph following the Sandy Springs, Georgia abortion clinic bombings, where he signs them or makes the statement, quote-unquote, death to the New World Order, I think people need to remember back to that time. This was at the very soon after the height of the militia movement, when radical right-wing conspiracy theories about a so-called New World Order taking over the United States were quite common. And what better symbol of internationalism and international cooperation than the Olympics? And I think it was actually quite a logical target for someone of his political outlook and beliefs.
And in a multiracial city.
In a multiracial city, a multiracial setting, and again, the Olympics as an event that's supposed to emphasize cooperation among people of different, you know, racial and ethnic groups around the world, different nationalities. Again, if what we know about Rudolph actually proves to be true, that he opposed abortion not simply because he believed it was the murder of the unborn, but more specifically, he believed it was eliminating white children from the gene pool, that added impetus to his racial outlook.
We have to leave it at that, Dan. We have to leave it at that, and that's plenty. Thank you so much.
Hey, thank you very much.
Dan Levitas, the author of the book, The Terrorist Next Door, The Militia Movement and the Radical Right.
You're listening to Here and Now. When you think of your basic theme park, globs of sticky cotton candy may come to mind, or a Ferris wheel towering over everything, maybe a roller coaster you can risk your neck on. But in Americus, Georgia, there's another kind of theme park. It's not an amusement park. In fact, it's kind of grim and dilapidated, and that's the point, because the theme at the new Global Village and Discovery Center is poverty. We're joined now on the line by Jack Yeager of Habitat for Humanity, the Christian charity that's created the new theme park. Welcome, Jack. So, Jack, if one came to the Global Village and Discovery Center, what would you see? Will you see mock-ups of what poverty looks like around the world, or what Habitat for Humanity does, which is to build homes for poor people?
Well, literally, you'd see both. On this 6-acre site, we start people out with the problem, in effect, the problem that the world has with poverty. So we have people walk through this sort of serpentine pathway, and it's fairly closed in, fairly tight, and you feel pretty depressed. You feel like, wow, you're thankful that you don't have to live in that area, but you'll also say, gee, that's too bad that people are faced with these, you know, kind of run-down tin, open wood, cardboard, any available materials, old, you know, disposed materials that are used for people to try to build their own homes around the world. But when you come out of that, what you start seeing are 15 houses in Habitat style from around the world. And so you'll see one house that might have a tile roof, and one house might have a tin roof, and one house might be made out of brick, and one house might be made out of a concrete block.
So it's experiencing poverty and also learning about what Habitat Humanity does for poverty. It's not an escapist theme park, though, is it?
Oh, definitely not. This is our theme vine is real world, real solutions.
Is this the sort of place you'd want to bring your kids, say, on a weekend, like most theme parks?
Yeah, I think it's a place to bring kids on weekends, on other trips. We're fairly located close to the main travel path going north-south, people heading for Florida. We said, you know, it's great to get away and have a good time and have fun and kind of escape your day-to-day, but, you know, maybe you need to connect back to reality on some of these trips and show your kids, say, look, this is how people live around the world, and it's not a, you know, ooh, yucky kind of experience. It's a, wow, look what people are really doing something for these people, and it's a serious, but it's also it's uplifting.
Yeah, and a participatory element too, right?
Right. The participatory part is we can show people, you know, what they can do, and we can also show them how we work, from how we build, you know, certain things, how we make bricks, how we make tile roof,
right?
How we, you know, hew the lumber that's used in houses in places like Papua New Guinea, where you have to build up on stilts.
Now, Jack, the park opens June 7th, but I imagine you've already had some previews. What kind of a reaction have you gotten so far?
Reaction's been great. People have walked in, said, we understand what you're trying to say, but we also just never had it hit us emotionally as much. We've thought about shore poverty as a problem, but wow, I never thought about what it would be like to live in this. I never thought it would be like, what if I didn't have a door on my house? The reaction is most people are very surprised at literally how efficiently we can build a home around the world and how little in U.S. dollars it really costs.
How many visitors do you expect the first year?
We estimate somewhere, 45,000 to 75,000. We feel like we'll see some groups come in. We're kind of wait and see on it. We like to say, you fight poverty one house at a time, and it's one person at a time. And so if every day one family comes through and we can make a difference, then, hey, that's great. And if it's a busload of people, that's great, too.
Mm-hmm. We wish you the best with it, Jack
Yeager. Thank you, Bill.
We were joined by Jack Yeager of Habitat for Humanity in Americas, Georgia.
There's more ahead here and now.
From Boston University, this is WBUR Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listener, also by the Lenox Hotel in Boston's Back Bay, recipient of AAA's Four Diamond Award and the American Hotel Association's Environmental Hotel of the Year Award 2000. By Cambridge School of Culinary Arts, more than 25 years offering individual classes, certificate, and professional degree programs for the cooking enthusiast, CambridgeCulinary.com. And by Crescent Ridge Dairy, the dairy that delivers, offering home delivery of farm fresh milk in glass bottles, now available at Bread and Circus Whole Foods markets and on the web at crescentridge.com. Our next Citizens of the World tour is going to Tuscany and Umbria this summer. You can learn more about that trip and sample the cuisine of Tuscany, courtesy of Bistro 5 in West Medford, at a pre-reception on Monday, June 9th. To reserve your space, call 800-909-9288.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Fact is often stranger and more compelling than fiction. And when you meld the two and take them back in time, you can end up with some pretty great reading material. Our literary correspondent Steve Almond is here in the studio to tell us about some new historical fiction. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Robin.
You're onto something here. I went online and just plugged in the words historical fiction, and boy, there's a lot of it.
Yeah, well, it never goes out of fashion.
Nope. From Stephen Crane's Red Badge of Courage to there's tons of them right now on the bestseller list. The Girl with a Pearl Earring, Tracy Chevalier's Story of the Girl Who Modeled for Vermeer. Mm-hmm. Anita Diamond has become a mainstay with her biblical stories. The Red Tent is one. And you were the first one, I believe, at least according to author Matthew Pearl, you were the first one to recognize Dante Club.
Yeah, that's a historical piece of fiction all about historical fiction, because it's, in fact, about Longfellow.
Right, and his passion for Dante. But so tell us, how accurate does an historical novel have to be?
Well, it's a great question. The rule is, as Flannery O'Connor said, you can get away with whatever you can get away with. Just can't get away with much. When you're modeling something on history, I think people choose to be incredibly close to history and really use those facts as a guideline, and other people really choose to just use it as a departure point. The captivating thing about historical fiction is really what you're trying to do, what makes it literature, is get inside the emotions of the characters and who can really say in the end what was going on inside Caesar's, heart at a particular moment as Brutus was going to betray him and so forth. That's why another great historical fiction writer, or we should say playwriter, probably the most famous in history, would be Shakespeare.
There you go.
He looked at history and said, aha, what in these stories and these characters is universal, speaks to these universal themes of desire and ambition and romance and the lust for power and the price we pay for following those desires.
Well, I've seen some of the covers of the books that you've brought in, and it seems like there's a little bit of lust and desire in them.
Well, it wouldn't be a literary segment with Steve Almond unless there was. Let me start with a beautiful novel called A Kiss from Maddalena. It's by a wonderful young writer named Christopher Castellani, and it is, in fact, the story of love, amore. It's set in the World War II era in Italy, and I'm just going to read the very opening, which will give you a flavor and also an indication of some of the romantic themes in the book. From the air, the village of Santa Cecilia appears in the shape of a woman lying down. If you'd been a pilot flying over it on your way to Germany or Africa or some other place to drop bombs, you'd have noticed how the main road forms a kind of spine leading to a round piazza where green trees fan out like hair over the hills and four narrow roads grow into limbs at both ends. One of the woman's arms cradles a cluster of white stone houses, the other stretches lazily into the fields in a way that suggests she is resting. If you'd been a pilot, young maybe, one of the thousands of boys soaring over every week, you'd have had a woman's figure on your mind anyway, and you'd have longed to land in this place, to hide with her from Hitler and Russia and the Passo Romano, and to lose yourself in the parts of her body you can only see up close.
Whoa, I was wondering where the history was, and there it was in the last sentence. I mean, it's a...
Yes, indeed.
Foreshadowing of what's to come.
It is indeed a love story between young Vito Leone and the aforementioned Maddalena of the title. And what I admire so much about the novel, you can hear how beautiful and lyrical the writing is. It's also very much a picture of the way that most people experience war. We obviously have our minds set on the people who are in combat, and there are many Red Badge of Courage and wonderful novels that are all about the experience of combat itself. But this is really a novel about that mirrors the experience most people have, which is being on the edge of a great trauma. And it's really a love story that is both beautiful and inspiring, but also very dark in places because it's set against this terrible tragedy.
Okay, so Chris Castellani's A Kiss from Maddalena, set in World War II, 1943?
Yes.
What else have you got?
I've got a wonderful book of short stories. We've talked a lot about historical novels, but I also want to mention that there are wonderful short story writers who write beautiful historical fiction. One has just come out from a writer named Carl Yanyema. It's called On the Nature of Human Romantic Interaction. Carl Yanyema is a robotics postdoctorate. He's actually a researcher at MIT, so he's a scientist, but he writes absolutely breathtakingly beautiful prose. And this book has eight short stories, and about half of them are beautiful historical pieces. I'm going to read a little bit from a piece called The Phrenologist's Dream. Do you know what phrenology is?
No, tell.
Phrenology is the telling people's future and their personality from the bumps on their skull.
Could happen.
Yes, it could happen. All Stranger right. things. That morning, he rose at sunrise and stepped into trousers and brogues in the tea-colored light. The room had no wash basin, so he wiped his face on his shirt tails and ran a finger along his gluey front teeth. On the side table lay a bottle of hair tonic, a pair of white satin gloves, and a scatter of coins that he counted by feel as he dropped them into his vest pocket, $10, 5.5 cents. Although the sum was considerable, Jeremiah felt a shade of disappointment. 24 examinations, half of them women, and not a single skull had quickened his heart. This is a story about a phrenologist who is, in fact, searching for the perfect skull.
You know, I love when somebody who has an expertise, and as you say, Carl Yanyema is an expert in robotics and apparently the sciences,
yes.
when then they're also a great writer.
Yeah, what's beautiful about this collection of stories is that Yanyema as a writer is always finds these strange historical episodes. There's another story about one of the a frontier doctor who was one of the first doctors to do experiments on the way that the stomach digests, because it so happens that there was he cared for an injured young man whose stomach was exposed. So he could feed him and actually see the way that the stomach digests food. And Carl Yanyema finds these quacky historical figures and really breathes real emotional content into a story that you would look at and say, oh, that seems odd. I wonder what was going through that person's mind.
We should say, too, Yanyema, I-A-G-N-E-M-M-A.
Yes, it's an Italian name. Okay. I don't know. Something in me is just a feeling Italian today.
Okay, Carl Yanyema, On the Nature of Human Romantic Interaction. What's next?
A beautiful novel just came out in paperback called The Visit of the Royal Physician. It is by Sweden's most famous writer, Per Olav Enquist, or maybe it's Enquist. I just want to say Enquist because I just like the way that sounds, but it's really Per Olav Enquist. I'm absolutely transfixed by this gentleman's writing. This novel is really about the dawn of enlightenment. Now, we hear a lot about enlightenment. It's sort of thrown around, the dawn of enlightenment. But to be totally honest, I wasn't really sure why it mattered so much that these principles that we take for granted, individual liberty and freedom to pursue the world of ideas and egalitarianism and so forth, they're just things you learn in school. A great piece of historical fiction makes you emotionally experience the heft and importance of historical events like the Enlightenment. In this case, it's a story of the King of Denmark, Christian VII, who is sort of half-witted, and his court doctor, really his chief advisor, whose name is Strunzi, who is a great advocate of the Enlightenment. And set against them is this villainous character, Goldberg, who's a really cold-blooded religious fanatic. It's a very famous incident in the history of Denmark. So it's really a court drama. And I'm just going to read a little piece that will give you an idea of the way that the Enlightenment functions in the novel.
And this novel is called The Visit of the Royal Physician.
Yes. The Swiss tutor was gaunt, stooped, and had a dream of the Enlightenment that was like a quiet and very beautiful dawn. At first, it was imperceptible, then it was there, and the day had begun. That's how he thought of it, gentle, quiet, and unresisting. That's how it should always be. And this is just the introduction of the idea that the Enlightenment isn't just something that you find in a history book. It's a terribly beautiful, important emotional event in the lives of the characters in the novel.
That sounds wonderful.
Yes, it's a beautiful book.
Well, for all of the books, you can go to our website, but we also encourage you to, when you go there, give us your suggestions as well. You can email us.
And I want to suggest just a couple of very funny historical novels. People tend to think of it as, oh, it's got to be serious or tragic. Really quickly, the book Water Music by T.C. Boyle is an absolutely hilarious novel that's sort of a version of A Tale of Two Cities, and a wonderful novel called Middle Passage by the writer Charles Johnson, which is a wonderful book about a freed slave and has lots to say about contemporary racial issues.
Okay. Steve, as usual, I've written them all down. Thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Here in our literary correspondent, Steve Allman, also the author of My Life in Heavy Metal, and he teaches creative writing at Boston College. If you didn't write everything down, go to our website, here-now.org. And don't forget, while you're there, email us. What are your thoughts of the best historical fiction?
Here and Now is a production of WBUR, Boston.
Our production team includes Andrea Shea, Lynn Menegon, April Peavy, Alan Cockle, Karen Miller-Medson, and Stefano Katsonis. Special thanks this week to Emiko Tamagawa. Our managing editor is Kathleen McKenna. Our editor is Mitch Wortlieb.
Vince Fairchild is our engineer. He's assisted by Tim Skog. Our web producer is Zach Christo. And our interns are Lindsay Crudell and Marisa Francini.
The senior producer of Here and Now is Mark Navin.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Get into your radio.
And join us again. Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software. Information on the web at mathworks.com.
This is W.
Works.com.
This is W.